Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Bill.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest today is Emily Smith. Emily, thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I usually give a little bio, read a bio before interviews, but I just thought today I would let you kind of explain, you know, kind of who you are as a person, but also professionally what you do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm a wife. I'm a mom. I live here in Central Texas. And so I'll just start off with that of when we're talking about this coronavirus, and I'll put on my science hat in a minute, but it's definitely coming in too as a mom of two little kids and homeschooling. We have been in Central Texas now for about 3 years. Prior to that, I worked at Duke University. So to put the science hat on, I am an epidemiologist. It's a great word to throw in if you're playing Jeopardy, because it's big. I'm not a skin doctor, not like an epidermis. I do get that quite often, which is fine. It's the study of epidemics. And so how do diseases spread? What causes them to spread? So it's super applicable right now in this coronavirus time. I got my PhD from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and started working at Duke University after that. So currently I remain on faculty there as an assistant professor of global health. And now I'm an assistant professor of epidemiology here at Baylor University. And my work has mainly focused on policy level implications in global health settings. You know, got to go to the United Nations to talk about universal health coverage. But now with COVID happening, all of that has been halted. You know, in my home, it's been halted, but also my research has been halted. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, that's perfect. I'm so excited that I get to be talking to, I mean, you're just like the perfect person for us to talk to during this time. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be here.
Yeah.
So I want to ask, I've got tons of questions for you. And most of these are questions that I come up with based on some questions I actually had, but some that I had from just conversations I was having with people. And then I even opened it up to people on Twitter and just said, hey, if you could ask an epidemiologist something, what would it be? And I got a lot of great questions there. So yeah, we'll just go through them. But I thought first, if it's okay, I want to just give you my understanding of the situation, and at the end, you tell me what I got wrong or what you would want to add to that, if that's okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So my understanding is this, you know, COVID-19 came about, obviously started somewhere in China and made its way over to the US. We kind of slowly saw, oh, this is going to be a big problem. And experts began recommending that we quarantine, and then even that began being implemented on the law level. And my understanding is that the quarantine is not so much so that less people get COVID-19, but that we spread out the cases of COVID-19. So we don't all get it at the same time, rather. And so that makes it so that we have plenty of rooms in our hospitals, enough physical rooms, enough nurses and doctors to take care of the people who've contracted it, enough ventilators to go around, enough medical supplies. So if we flatten the curve, as we say, we will have enough time to take care of everyone. There'll be enough to go around. Whereas if we don't flatten the curve and we will overwhelm our hospitals and not have enough supplies, and all this will create more people will die from the disease because we have less people to take care of them, less supplies to take care of them. So how did I do, Emily? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think that everybody knows what flatten the curve is now, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do.
But yes, I mean, that is in essence what got a lot of people's attention, was when we understood flattening, the importance of flattening the curve. The only thing I would add to that too is this is not the common cold, because there are other types of coronaviruses. This is not the flu. It's a new virus that none of us have been exposed to ever. And so our immune system has no defense, which is why you see these dramatic exponential increases in cases and severity that overwhelm the health system. So that's why this is all new. That's why flatten the curve was important. You know, the flu is deadly for sure. I mean, you don't want to get that. But we have a vaccine for the flu, and so people that get that are fully or partially protected. The severity isn't as bad. So there's that curve never really gets over to the point of what we're seeing this do in terms of infection and hospitalization rates. So, you know, it's just brand new. It's a once in 100-year type virus.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you said that, because my next question was going to be, how is this different from the flu? And so is it, do we, the normal flu, the influenza that we have seasonally every year, do most people walking around have a slight immunity to that, just because we've been exposed to flu in previous seasons? And I understand that the flu mutates a bit every year, but it's still somewhat the same thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it is seasonal. And so we need the yearly vaccine to reboost. But our body has seen at least something like it.
Yeah.
And so it is not brand new. And even if you don't get a vaccine, others around you might have. And so there's protection from a population standpoint through the vaccine too. But yeah, I mean, your body develops, it gets bolstered by, you know, being exposed to that either through the vaccine or just through the flu itself. So it is very different than the flu, but it's also different. Not that it's new, but it's also different because it's just more deadly. And we don't quite know why yet. You know, the havoc that it wreaks on people's lungs, and we're seeing kidney and brain affected now, is just different than the flu. So different in a lot of ways.
When people were first making that comparison, I thought, well, before I researched anything, just my first thought was, well, at the very least, we have a vaccine for the flu. And right. So you can, and I didn't even think about what you said, which is, if you do, even if you don't get the shot, the flu vaccine, there's still plenty of people around you who have, so that restricts the passing around of the flu every year. And yeah, so we have a vaccine, it's not as deadly. And then I've heard as well that that COVID-19 is simply more contagious, that people are, which, and I guess that goes back to the immunity thing. If we don't always contract the regular influenza because we've got a little bit of immunity with COVID-19, it spreads easily because we don't have those immunities. Is that right?
Yeah. The contagiousness of this is a little different than that, though. You're correct in what you're saying, but the flu has, so technically, you call the contagiousness what's called R-naught, if you hear that around in the news. But it is how much one virus in one person can infect somebody else. So something like the flu, if I get it, I can infect, you know, one to two other people. Something like measles has an R-naught of 9. So in a community that has no vaccination against it, one person with measles can infect up to 9 other people. So the R-naught for COVID is about 2 to 5. And so even if it's on an equal playing field, if we get a vaccine with the flu, it is still more contagious than the flu, because one person can spread it to between 2 to 5 other people. And it spreads very, very easily. You know, cough, sneeze, aerosol for a few hours. It can live on plastic and stainless steel for up to 3 days. So the R-naught of this one is higher than the contagiousness of the flu.
So I'm going to jump to one of my other questions because that made me think of it, which is, you know, now we're a lot of us are walking around with masks. And it seems like there's been a little bit of conflicting information about whether or not masks are helpful, whether they actually would stop the spread of COVID-19. Someone yesterday pointed out to me that back in at the end of February, the actual Surgeon General was telling people not to go buy masks, that they weren't effective. Also that they were, you know, taking them away from the medical community, which that seemed kind of like both can't be true, right? Which I was really surprised that somebody brought that to my attention, because my understanding was that most experts now were advising people to wear masks.
Yeah, I think at the beginning it was to make sure that we don't do with masks what we did with toilet paper and buy them all up, and then there's nothing left for healthcare workers.
Okay.
Now we are understanding a little bit more of the data behind wearing masks. And I think with the COVID in general, with this new virus and any questions that we have to keep in mind that scientists and microbiologists and medical doctors and epidemiologists were learning on the fly as we track this thing. So I think that is why some recommendations get flip-flopped, because we're just learning what works and what doesn't work. In terms of are they effective, you know, the CDC put out some really good guidelines of how to make a mask at home that would be effective, one that has a filter, and what materials you should use. Should you double or triple up, and how do you wear it and take it off properly? So I would just recommend going to the CDC website on what fabric to use. You know, does it need to cover the ears or not? So they release some really good practical information about masks, but we wear them if we go out to protect ourselves, but also just to protect others in case we're infected and we don't know.
Okay, that's super. That's really good to know. I was saying on Twitter yesterday, you know, if I saw contradictory evidence of, you know, like a peer-reviewed study that said masks didn't work, well, I would go with the data versus my own opinion, you know, hopefully. But it seems obvious to me that if I sneeze with a mask on, then it dramatically reduces the spread versus if I sneeze without a mask on.
Yeah, and the weird thing about this virus too is you can be sick for up to 14 days without knowing that you're sick.
Right, right.
And some of the highest viral loads in your ability to infect others is within that period that you have no symptoms. So it's just really important to think about those type of precautions. Was that allergies or
sure.
Was that cough? Maybe I'm developing symptoms. You know, by the time most of us know if we actually do have it and we need to go get a test, there's possibility that we could have spread that very widely.
I want to go back to just the hospitals and, you know, the idea of flattening the curve so we don't overwhelm them. I think that's so hard for us to comprehend because we've never experienced a hospital being at capacity and what that might look like. Like, it sounds like something that might happen in a third world country or a long time ago, like centuries ago, right? And so I wonder just like what would that like, one, is it possible to happen? And what would that look like?
Yeah, it is hard. It's like a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. It is, exactly.
I'm an epidemiologist, so I've seen all those movies. yeah, and I work in global communities around the world, so we are used to seeing this you know, the hospitals being at capacity, there being three doctors when you really need 15. And so with it being a little hard to comprehend, it makes sense because we haven't seen that, especially here in the States or, you know, in Europe. And could it happen and what that would look like? It could happen. And I think we saw that, or I don't think I know we saw that in, unfortunately, in New York when it just got beyond the point of control. And so when you think about how contagious this thing is, you know, when you think about the curve, You know, it's almost like a roller coaster. There is a steep incline to cases, not a stair step, one plus one plus one. So if you get past a certain point of infections, it overwhelms that healthcare system, and it is really hard to interrupt that race. And so what that looks like is lots of people needing oxygen support, even if they don't all need ventilators, which we know the sickest of the sick will need ventilators. There's still oxygen. You still feel miserable. There's kidney functionings and brain abnormalities, or, you know, it's affecting the brain at this point. So overwhelming the healthcare system doesn't just mean ventilators. It also means beds. And do we have enough PPE, masks and gloves for the people that are actually taking care of them to not, you know, overwhelm the rest or infect the other healthcare workers or cleaners? And you think of the staffs within the hospital. So can it happen? Yes. Can it happen very quickly? Very quickly. I mean, we think it feels like we've been living in this quarantine world for 3 years now. Right. And in, you know, reality, it's been 6 or 7 weeks. And so it takes 2 to 3 weeks to get from 100 cases to tens of thousands. And it's hard to comprehend that, but it is what we've seen in the data. So it can happen very quickly.
Yeah, that is so crazy. And there was a while where I was thinking, like, well, maybe like the capacity of hospitals should be the biggest metric that we look at. Meaning, like, you know, if we look at our hospitals and say, like, they're 25% full, okay, we've got plenty of room, maybe we can ease restrictions. But what I wasn't factoring in was just, like you said, how quickly, if we ease restrictions, like you said, in however many days, we will be seeing the effect of that. So, you know, theoretically, it can jump overnight. And we could be overwhelmed.
Yeah. I mean, in the US, it took 10 days to get to 20,000 cases.
Yeah.
And it doesn't comprehend, but it's all wrapped up into, a few things. One, a lack of immunity, but another, that are not the contagiousness and how many people can get it from one person.
So we're already so far in this thing that we've politicized it. We've somehow made science political here. And so people are kind of dividing into their factions. And when I talk to the people who are for reopening, they point to the health risks that come with quarantining further. So, you know, you look back at the recession in 2008, the suicide rate went up. And that happens when people lose jobs and are, you know, facing hard economic times. And also during quarantine, the rate of abuse, people who are in abusive relationships or in homes with their abusive partners or parents or whatever. And so a lot of the people who are for reopening are saying, we're not looking at the big picture. If we're valuing the lives of people who battle with depression or people who are in abusive relationships, if we value them as much as people who would die of COVID-19, we would see that that it would be actually better to reopen. Is it possible that the medical community is you know, focused on doing their jobs, and so their job is to keep people from dying of medical issues, but they're not seeing the bigger picture? And might it be better for us to reopen to save more lives?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a hard question, because there's no good way out of this. There's, you know, we're in it now. And so trying to get out of that and having to come up with these solutions where there's no perfect solution for everybody is just so difficult. And we saw that early in when they were shutting down schools. You know, that was a very hard decision because I believe it was the right decision. We would have seen a huge increase in cases had we not done that. But that also meant that children that relied on those lunches did not have that anymore.
Right.
Children that that had hard home situations to begin with are now home all day. People who deal with depression and anxiety that cannot get out and now live in isolation, this is likely highly exacerbating that. So I think when they're making these decisions, I mean, certainly there are people that are only thinking one way.
Yeah.
I am, an epidemiologist, so I'm in the field of public health. And all of these are public health issues. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because usually there's two perspectives. One is the MD, the nurse, the physician perspective, which thinks about treatment. It's treating the individual, in general. Public health thinks about treating the population, protecting the population as a whole. So even before COVID, we were asking these questions of a public health, which includes depression and anxiety and food insecurity, abuse and how to get out of that, preventative measures. So now that COVID, it's another layer of public health, of tracing the epidemic, of seeing who is on risk, while at the same time knowing that people's lives just got a lot harder. So I don't think there's a good question, or I'm sorry, a good answer for that. I think it's a reality of the situation. I do think that COVID has the potential to kill more people than a lot of other public health issues. That does not diminish other public health issues at all. It just means that we have to be creative. You know, one of my great friends at Baylor is at the Texas Hunger Initiative. So he is trying to figure out how do we get food to hundreds of thousands of families in the U.S. for as long as they need it.
Yeah.
I've got friends in Houston that are trying to figure out, can we make safe spaces for families that need to get out of some type of abusive situation? How do we do telemedicine for suicide and depression prevention? So I just think we have to get creative, but I think the wrong thing to do is to try to compare all public issues one-to-one-to-one instead of realizing we live now in a holistic situation and everything is going to contribute and kind of multiply on each other. So I hope that answered.
Yeah, it does. I'm thinking through that answer as you were talking. One thing it makes me think is, I think sometimes what we do is we say, okay, quarantine is causing a rise in depression, so we need to stop doing quarantine, rather than thinking, how is this exposing the deficiencies in our mental health system?
Yeah.
Or our food insecurity system, meaning, and why are we not just trying, instead of just saying, let's not quarantine anymore, why aren't we trying to solve the underlying problems that this is just exposing?
Right. Or just saying, why can't we reopen what is needed to combat those issues, but at the same time, not open up things that are non-essential that could be seen as vacation or privilege?
Yeah.
So I think there are gradations of combating this problem instead of it being all or nothing.
Yeah, that's great. Do you feel like as so many states are doing different things, some are, I don't know if any state's completely reopened. I feel like I have heard that. But like here in Texas, we're kind of doing some half measures where some things are opening and then we're waiting and seeing. And then, of course, some states are closing, still locked down completely. And I'm curious if you see someone, a governor or lawmakers who you feel like are doing it well right now.
I think the ones that are listening to and watching the data and having patience to reopen, because right now in Texas, where we both are, some of the highest increases that we've seen since this began has been this week at the same time of reopening. So the ones that are doing it, even according to what governmental officials of the task force are saying to do, is to do it very, very carefully. Watch to see if there's an increase, and then it's almost like tiptoe. Mm-hmm. What we see in some states, though, is just full-blown jump in the pool instead of tiptoeing in and watching the data. Because this thing is not going to end really anytime soon. Just because we flattened the curve does not mean that curve can't go back very, very quickly. Like, there's nothing magical about, we did a good job at staying home to flatten that first curve, and it's over. Let's go, you know, resume life as normal. The governors that are, I think, in the states that are doing it correctly are being very cautious about what they're opening, and then they're waiting to look. And by waiting, I mean not just a day.
Yeah.
Because if you remember, you know, if I get infected today, it could take 2 weeks to show symptoms. So waiting at least 3 weeks to see, do we see an increase or still we doing okay? And then tiptoe a little bit more. So that's the part that makes me nervous about these reopenings, is some of them are rolled out week by week by week, with very broad openings on what, you know, how that's defined. So my worry is there's going to be a kind of a pool of people who are going to get infected, and we're not going to see it until 3 to 4 weeks, when it's probably too late.
So it sounds like when we take these reopening measures, there needs to be a really long pause to see what the results of those are.
Yes, that's data driven. That's not because we all want to be out.
Yeah, right.
We all want to get our hair done. And I want to take my kids to where they typically go in the summer. So I get that. But I think we need to be cautious and watch the data.
I think we all kind of felt like since this started, you know, once we allow everyone to get infected, that's obviously, I mean, that's the final outcome. Barring a vaccine, is that, you know, we're all going to get it at some point. So on a long enough timeline, at least. I think the kind of assumption was once we got it, we would be immune and wouldn't get it again. And now it sounds like we're having some data that says we're not really sure about that. Do you know, if someone gets a antibody test and it comes back positive, that they have the antibodies that show that they had COVID-19, or maybe they knew they were in the hospital and they recovered after that. Do we know, or can they get it again, and can they spread it again?
Yeah, we don't know yet. And that's the hard part about this, is most of these questions we don't know yet, because this is brand new. Which is why I just keep urging people to just have patience with the scientists and the people who are in charge on trying to figure out this issue. So there are two separate things I want to talk about with the antibodies and immunity. The first is there has not been a test prior to this to really test for this, one, whether or not you're infected, you know, when they do the swab, the nose swab. And also this antibody test, which is like a blood prick on the finger. So they had to develop something. And that means that there have been some tests on the market that have not been perfect at all. Hmm. In fact, some of the antibody tests have given false positives, a lot of false positives. So what that means is it's picking up some type of infection, but it's not COVID-19. It could be another type of coronavirus, or, you know, a whole bunch of different things, just because we're having to develop these tests very quickly. So that's one issue of, you have to find the test that is correct. So the FDA has cracked down on those tests, that if you use the antibody test, it needs to be 99% what's called sensitive and specific. Mm. That's two epidemiologic terms to determine if the test is actually telling you what it wants to. So that has just started to be rolled out. So I would want to use that test only if I want to take the antibody test. Mm. And then the issue of if we're immune to not, we just don't know yet, because this has not run a full cycle of a season to know if you can be reinfected. You know, I know there are some reports that some in Wuhan were testing negative and then positive again.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean they got reinfected. It also doesn't mean that they were sick again. It could just be the dead virus being picked up.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we just don't know yet about immunity. You know, that people have hunches based on other coronaviruses or with the flu. You know, if you get it, then you're pretty protected for a bit, but we don't know yet.
Yeah. And that's what's so crazy, because then we really are just waiting on a vaccine, because, you know, it could just be like every few months we would be, you know, going through this again. There'd be another curve or whatever forever.
Yeah, that's a possibility. From what I'm seeing in the data, I think that is unlikely.
Yeah, good.
But we don't have enough to support what I just said. But that's my hunch.
Yeah. Well, what about if it is possible to contract it twice, is it then more deadly to that person because their immune system's been compromised from having it the first time? Or does it work the other way around? Do they have the immunity?
I think it's unlikely to get it twice from what we're seeing. And if you do get it twice, you have built up antibodies against it. So I don't think you would be as sick. But that's just from how the other coronaviruses, you know, you've got a little bit of a defense because your body has already seen it.
Gotcha. So speaking of the vaccine, there's been a lot of false hope out there. And so, you know, I want to be careful, but I do want to know what your opinion is. It seems like there's so many possible vaccines and trials now, and, you know, some stage of the process. How hopeful and optimistic are you that we'll see a vaccine? And then again, there's probably a lot of speculation here, but how much time do you think that would take?
Yeah. So I'm always going to be an optimist. You can ask my family about that. So but I'm also a scientist. And so I am actually hopeful for a vaccine. We have some very, very smart people, many that I know in person. Peter Hotez is working on one at the Baylor College of Medicine. There's a great group in Oxford, you know, lots of pharmaceutical companies working very hard. And I think what we saw with the Ebola crisis, when that happened in Sierra Leone, a vaccine was developed very quickly. And it worked well. And a lot of that is just the science community and vaccine developers knowing what to do and what it's going to take. So I'm actually hopeful for a vaccine quickly. Now, how quick is that going to be? January, or is that going to be September? I think within the next month, we will probably have a better sense of that. But I am hopeful. I'm very hopeful, actually, for a vaccine, just from talking with some really smart friends that are working on them.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of just shift and talk about not so much the science, but just who we can look to for good information. And then also address some specific misinformation that's out there, possible misinformation. One of the things, these things kind of come in waves. It seems like every day there's a new batch of misinformation. Like there's a new wrong thing out there that people are spreading. One of the things lately is that the CDC and maybe other organizations are inflating the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths. And I think that's been some kind of version of that, of, hey, we're overcounting, has been around for a little while. And so I just wonder what you think of that, you know, how we as a country are counting them, and if you think that is producing an overcount or an undercount, and then, you know, specifically the CDC, if the way that they're keeping track too.
Yeah. Well, and at the beginning, the number of cases and the number of deaths were based on modeling projections from, you know, the biggest one was from the University of Washington. And I have some really good friends that work up there. So they were basing those models on what could happen based on what we saw in China and Italy and other places. So then when we started seeing the actual people getting sick and then the actual deaths and counting those numbers are the real people. So I don't think it's an inflation. I actually wonder if it is an underestimate of the true depth of this thing, just because the cases that are counting, that we're counting as deaths due to coronavirus, are those that had a positive test, not those that, you know, perhaps had some other type of underlying health condition. They got infected, and if they died and weren't tested positive, they would not be counted in that. And given what we know about this disease and how deadly it can be, especially with elderly, you know, over 60, 65, but also younger folks with underlying conditions like diabetes, and we think of obesity, what it can do to the heart, I think the numbers we're seeing are an underestimate.
That's kind of from what I read as a very non-medical professional. I kind of got that impression too. There was a, you may know about this, but there was a story that came out about Belgium and the way Belgium is counting COVID-19 deaths. And on paper, it looks like they're doing terribly. It looks like a lot more people are dying. And part of the reason for that is because they are, my understanding is that they are counting people who died at home, so outside of the hospital, but with COVID-19 symptoms.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there probably is, there may be a little overcount in Belgium. I'm not saying that that's a better way or a worse way, but it makes me think, because we're not counting them that way, because my understanding is they have to have a confirmed case for us to count them as a COVID-19 death, that we're likely undercounting.
Right, right. And I mean, I think it's a slippery slope when you count a case who is symptomatic for COVID, because this thing looks like a lot of other things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, pneumonia could be just pneumonia, or it could be coronavirus-related pneumonia. So I think there is a middle ground that we can perhaps think about, but we also have testing to be able to test some of these people to know if it truly was a COVID infection or not. I think this is a great example of miscommunication, of maybe jumping too quickly to think about the issues before reading a little bit more about it. And what I mean by that is I do know there's a lot of pushback on the CDC, you know, their cases going from, what, 60,000, and then it dropped to 37,000 on their website.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because they separated out the deaths to be people who died only of COVID-19. And then if you look at the next column, it's people who died of COVID-19 plus pneumonia. And then the next column is people who died of COVID-19 plus something else, plus something else. Mm. So if you really want to get the accurate number, which is like the 60,000, you need to add up all of those columns. So, you know, in a day and age where there's just rapid fire information, I would just ask people to just to talk to the real experts, and we can define who that is in a minute, on how do you interpret that? You know, this, now they're saying this, but that doesn't reconcile with what I heard yesterday. And most of the time there is a scientific explanation or a legit way to think about it, other than it thrown hands up in the air and just not, you know, not believing anything anymore.
I think it is so important for people when they see something posted on Facebook that looks like something's up, instead of immediately assuming that something shady is going on and resharing that, to just dig a little bit. It's so often, I mean, almost every time when I see something like that, it is literally a 5-second Google search for me to find out what's really going on behind that. There are enough journalists, and there are enough experts out there who are finding out the truth, that we can dig and we can find out what's going on. And so, I just think it's so important for people to just hold off for 1 second, do a little bit of independent research to find out what the story is. And then, like you said, to talk to someone who's in the medical field, and not just someone who you know will tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to recognize that even in the medical field, people come from different perspectives.
Yep.
And so the MDs are going to have an expertise that I don't. Us PhDs and epidemiologists have an expertise that they don't. Sometimes there's an overlap, but not all the time. And a classic example is the viral YouTube video of the two doctors.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that got debunked.
Yeah.
They did a, and I'll use air quotes, a study of people that have antibody tests. We can reopen because a ton of people are testing positive. But that's from a, that is not a proper study, because the, only the people that they were giving those tests to are those that were coming into urgent care, probably symptomatic. The tests that they were using had very poor performance, so we're not quite sure if they're accurate or not. So that's a classic MD perspective. And y'all, and I love MDs. This is not knocking them out. I work with a ton of surgeons and MDs. But it is a perspective of an individual perspective. I will try to do a study. Therefore, this is what I, you know, this is what we should do in terms of reopening. That is really, really slippery if you do not do these studies correctly. Because then you get a biased example. One way to think about it is if I, you know, my son's 9, if I go to his class and ask him who wants ice cream for lunch, well, yeah, they're all going to say I do. Because the sample and who I'm asking these questions to matters, and it creates bias if you don't do these studies correctly. So I, you know, that went viral for a reason, probably because it was, maybe it gave people hope.
Yeah, that's what, you know, we wanted
to
hear.
Thinking, yeah, if you're already thinking about reopening, then this is going to validate it and just go for it. So what I would ask people to do is just to be like what you said, to be patient, to talk with somebody instead of just going one way or the other. Another example is, you know, at the beginning of all this, one certain treatment was touted as being a miracle drug. But then they started giving that treatment out to people and noticed, wait a minute, this is causing a ton of heart abnormalities. So now they're recommending not using that type of drug and using a different type. It's not because they got it wrong in the beginning. It's because this is a new virus and we're learning on the fly what works or what doesn't. So I just keep trying to urge people to, when you see things that don't reconcile with one another, one, it could just be really bad information, but another could be we're just learning about the virus as it's happening. So just to be patient, you know, it's not because scientists or people necessarily did everything wrong in the beginning, although there was some of that. It could just be we're just learning what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. And there are also just honest mistakes as well, you know, that we're, yes, just, as you said, we're learning as we're going. And I'm so glad you brought up that video of those two doctors. You know, they're, like you said, there was a lot of flaws in the way that they were going about their research. And I mean, to me, it seems like if you're a practicing doctor, well, you only have what you're seeing in front of you, and that counts, but it is by nature anecdotal, and those doctors were in like Fresno or Bakersfield, you know, central California. And there's just no, even if they were doing it right, to follow the lead on two doctors who only had the experience in those very small areas, that seems really dangerous.
Yeah, because the infections there are much, much higher, or in New York, than in Texas.
Right.
So just because 30% of the population might test positive there does not mean that's what we should do here.
This is kind of a big question. You've kind of talked about this a little bit, but, you know, part of the problem for those of us who aren't in the medical community, it's just so hard to know who to listen to. And to know where the truth is coming from. So I kind of liken it to, even in in the world of theology and biblical studies. I was reading this book several months ago that it was just very academic, a book about biblical studies. And I'm reading it, and part of my frustration was I realized I don't have the education or the expertise to even evaluate the veracity of what this book is saying. You know what I mean? Like it makes sense, and it sounds right, but there are other people also in academy who say that this is not right, that there's things wrong. And part of my frustration is I don't even have the expertise to evaluate whether this is good information or not. And it's the same way so much with medical information. Well, here's a medical professional and they're telling me this. Right. And then there's this other professional. And then there's also a perception that the medical community is very divided on what reality is right now and whether we should reopen or whether, the death count, the way that we count them is accurate. And news outlets can find one dissenting opinion and make it seem like it's split 50-50 in the medical community.
Right.
I don't know if there was a question in there. That was more of a rant.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. I don't really think that the medical community is as split as it probably seems in the news, just because everything is so either politicized or whiplash response and right now. So I'm not quite sure about that. I am certainly listening to those in the hardest hit areas. So I'm listening to those in New York, and I'm listening to the MDs in New York and their experiences on, are we over exaggerating? Is this too big of a deal? Are y'all opening up? How are you doing it? And their responses are very interesting because they have just lived through a really horrific time and coming off the end of that. So they can probably tell us the truth of what this looks like when it hits an area very, very hard. And as far as experts of who I'm listening to, certainly Dr. Fauci, I mean, we all know his name at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. He straddles both MD and PhD scientific world. And he's doing a great job at it, but I definitely listen to what he says. On my Facebook page, I noted a couple of others that I'm listening to, one from like a vaccine, a microbiology type standpoint, one from a treatment standpoint. So who should we believe on what to use in treatment? And all of that is outside of my expertise. Mm. From an epidemiologic standpoint, there are Dr. Mark Lipsnitch is, I want to say he's in the East somewhere. And he works a lot with these type of models and studies and how to design them correctly. So there are a few that I'm listening to. And then the others, you know, if they say something that doesn't quite sit well, then I will usually put it against the plumb line of those that I really, really trust. And, you know, those that I mentioned on my Facebook page, they've been doing this for decades. Some of them have been doing this type of work since the AIDS epidemic started coming out, when, you know, people started getting sick and they had no idea what it was.
Yeah, sure.
So they've lived a little bit of this already, and have earned that trust and that confidence. So those are the people I'm listening to and remaining very okay with me saying, I do not know. If you're going to ask me a treatment question, I don't know, because I'm not an MD. But let's go find out instead of forming an opinion about it. So I think some humility in listening to voices that really are the experts.
So Emily, if you would, we all know Dr. Fauci, but some of the others, could you, after we get done, can you send me those names and I'll put them on the show notes for the show and link to where people can find them online. And so we can let people just kind of have an index of experts to go to.
Yes. And the people that I will note and I have on my page too, they go and do interviews on CNN and on Fox. So it kind of gives you the, you know, they are doing this from a health standpoint, not a political one.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that. I love that. So the next thing that I wanted to ask is more of a philosophical or spiritual question. And so many people that I've talked to who are for reopening accuse those who are not for reopening of being driven by fear. And I thought, that seems very strange to me because one, the reason I'm practicing social distancing and quarantining is not because I'm afraid I'm going to get it. If I get it, I will have at worst flu-like symptoms for a while and then be fine. I'm a healthy 30-something man, so I'll be okay with that. I am doing it to protect my elderly neighbors, to protect my friends that are pregnant, that are immunocompromised, that have had recovered from cancer and things like that. So the fear is certainly not for me. And then as for it being for other people, it seems like I want to make the distinction when the fear is based on evidence. That it's there are actual risks here that data can back up. And I just, you know, wondered your thoughts on that, because I think you've probably had to think a lot about that sort of thing.
Oh, for sure. Especially because I am a Christian and I just believe firmly in the power of prayer and healing and Jesus and the cross and, you know, all of that. While at the same time, I'm a scientist. And so there's a difference between fear and anxiety that comes from data and fear and anxiety that comes from just not knowing. And then, you know, you trying to play God in an essence of taking your chances. We're all going to die at some point. That is not, in this case, it's not wisdom. And so what I've really had to wrestle with is, am I looking out just for myself and wanting my comfort and my conveniences, or am I trying to love my neighbor?
Yes.
And in that sense, loving my neighbor does not mean going over to my neighbor's home who is elderly and hanging out. You know, it is taking care of them. You know, if they need toilet paper and food, I will be very careful in, you know, ordering something and all of that. But loving my neighbor means inconveniencing myself for just a little bit of time. This is not forever. And I have to remind myself of that a lot. Of this will end at some point if we do our job. So I just want to love my neighbor as myself. And that means that I, even being in my 30s, and I might not be as high of a risk, although it looks like even some of us that are young can be very, very sick with this. It means that I have an opportunity to love my family and my neighbors in a way that just feels different than I've ever had to do before.
Yeah.
Because it means that I isolate. Yeah. It means that I do my job, and that feels weird because we're not doing at that point. I'm just being, you know, I'm just being me and staying home. So I think redefining freedom and what that means in Christ. And it certainly means that I am free, but I'm also free to love. I'm also free to use wisdom. I'm free to use my mind and to think of others before myself. And so that means that my physical actions of not going out and, you know, not doing my part to stay home becomes a very real reality. And it you know, it can become an inconvenience, but putting others above myself through love just looks different right now than it probably has ever for any of us.
Yeah. That's so good, Emily. So good.
I just looked over at my notes and I wanted to talk about herd immunity.
Oh, well, let's do it.
Okay. Cause that seems to be a lot of questions right now is let's just open the doors and let people go for it. But not a good idea.
So yeah, herd immunity, you're not a fan is what you're saying.
No.
Why won't that work in this situation?
So herd immunity is something where 70, 80, 90% of the population needs to be exposed to something to develop protection for the rest of the population. So that is a lot of people when you think of how many millions of people live in the U.S. Herd immunity works well for something that is not very virulent. You know, it causes a little bit of discomfort, but not deaths like we see with COVID. So the problem, if we just open the floodgates and let everybody interact with one another, is we will see steep curves that go very, very high. And then all healthcare systems have a chance of being overwhelmed. So herd immunity, we've got to be very cautious with, and I just don't think it's going to work with something like COVID.
So I think a lot of us are familiar with like chicken pox parties where like parents will bring their kids in kindergarten to play together that they know have one or two have chicken pox and just let them get it and get over with it so that when they, whatever, go to kindergarten or whatever, that's not something they have to worry about during an inconvenient time. It seems like what you're saying is if the death rate for chicken pox were the same as COVID-19, no one would be doing that. And that would be a terrible idea.
Exactly. It is not apples to apples at that point. These are very different diseases where something like Ebola, you know, highly, highly fatal is not the chicken pox either. Hmm. So you combat diseases differently depending on what that disease looks like. And we run a huge risk of just opening the floodgates and letting people do COVID-19 parties because of how scary it is, even to younger people.
And again, it seems like it all goes back to overwhelming the system and not having enough supplies and hospital space and doctors and things like that for everyone. And part of something that I was thinking was, you know, that really, for whatever reason, if I think I and my family are super people, super men and women that aren't going to get this disease, that doesn't mean that I might not need a doctor for something else at some point. It's kind of the problem that looked like we were going to have with chloroquine, where people were buying it up and trying to get prescriptions for it. And there were people who, you know, tested. They absolutely knew that they needed that for a different condition and were afraid that it was going to be in short supply. It's kind of the same thing. We don't, all of us, COVID-19 is not the only medical condition in the world right now. We need to make sure that there's enough for everyone.
Absolutely. And we're, you know, we see that disruption right now with some type of surgeries and therapies are just getting halted because of it right now. So yeah, we run that risk. And, you know, when we talk about flattening the curve, it is about not overwhelming the health system, but it's also about making sure there is enough time to understand the science and the mechanics of this virus. So we need more time to realize, like your chloroquine example, does it work or does it not work? And now we flip-flopped on that. But then there's other treatments that are being in development. And if we can flatten the curve enough to just get to those treatments, something like a Tamiflu, I'm very hopeful for something like that coming up. Then we can wait for that to be developed before a whole lot of people get sick. So we need more time for health systems, but we also need more time to allow scientists to make treatments and to figure out what is this and how can we prevent it more.
That's a great point, because it seems like every day in the news, we kind of inch closer to knowing. We know something, some little something every day that we didn't know the day before. So yeah, we're much more... it's much better for us to get it later than sooner because we know more information than we did yesterday and we'll know more tomorrow.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling. 6 weeks ago, we didn't know about treatments for this, at least most of them. We didn't know the droplet aerosolization that happens, like when somebody is getting put on a ventilator and how that is spread how the people need to be fully protected. We're learning all of that. Has the virus mutated or not? And does sunshine kill it or not? How long does it live on cardboard or plastic? And, you know, those things that we didn't really know 6 weeks ago. So I think we need to remember that flattening the curve is to understand as much as we can about it to save lives.
Well, I want to know, is there anything that we can do to support you? And I mean that in terms of, yes, you specifically, but also how people in general can support people in the medical community.
Yeah, well, that's a nice question.
I can't take full credit. Somebody on Twitter brought that question to me, so I can't take full credit, but we do want to know.
Well, way to go, humanity. It's awesome. I mean, I think this is to support those of us who are trying to be on the front lines in terms of not really treating the people, but, you know, informing and data, trying to talk about this in lay terms. I think the best way to support all of that is to just be patient and to be very careful about blame. I think we saw this before COVID, just because we're in a social media world. But just to take care of one another and to realize that we're all in this together, and we're all in this together in a very, very new way that we've never seen before. So I would just be as patient as everybody can with everyone, knowing that we all have, you know, something difficult to go in this sense. So I probably did that away from me a whole lot, but but I think just being patient, and everybody seems to be more on edge than normal, and that is okay. That's expected, because it's where we are right now. But, you know, I think mercy and compassion is going to play a lot for everybody right now.
So something I think that is so cool is that you have a Facebook page where you spread good, reliable information. And so can you, I'll post a link to it on the show notes to the show, but can you tell people where they can find you on Facebook?
Yeah, it's at Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist. I should have made that shorter now that.
We'll get it out there.
Yeah, there we go. It's not Friendly Neighborhood. That's a group. It's Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist. And so I just try to take reliable information and make it understandable, or distill it if you don't have time to read the full paper.
Sure.
You know, here's some sources to go to. So that's the Facebook page. I made it with the intention of just trying to help friends and family figure out what to do. And it just seems to be resonating with people that that want some information.
Yeah, that's great. That's so great. Emily, I'm so excited about just getting this information out there to people. And it's been so good to talk with you and sort through some of this stuff. You've been so generous with your time and your expertise. So thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And this is, you know, we're in this for the long haul. So I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.